Today is April the 26th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the Original Personal Computer Radio Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. Our guest this evening is Gaida Magdanarov. He's Vice President and General Manager at Acronis. Before we get to the interview with him, we have the following important computer news the past week. Hey, Joe, are you there?
I am here, Hank, but a lot of people have asked me, isn't it windy up at the top of the Empire State Building where we're located?
Well, you have a hard time trying to stay atop the Empire State Building holding a glass of tequila, huh?
I don't like tequila.
Well, we have, before we get to Acronis, we do have a couple of quick news items that I do want to cover. Harry Husky, probably very few old-timers remember who he is, but he is a real pioneer in the field of computing. He was he's one of the last remaining engineers that worked on the ENIAC, E-N-I-A-C, the very first electronic computer. And it's quite a unit. It was developed during World War II, and it was introduced right at the end of World War II. And by the way, Joe, the unit weighed 30 tons.
Yeah, I saw pictures of it. But what I remember most about the ENIAC, Hank, is not the ENIAC, but is a hobbyist model of it called the GENIAC, which was advertised constantly in Saturday, the Scientific American. And I was very disappointed when I got mine. It was very bad instructions on how to assemble it.
Well, Harry was also credited in the 1950s with the development and design of the Bendix G15, which was then billed as the very first personal computer. Of course, we think of a personal computer as being very different in size now. Let me quickly go through another item, which I'm sure that, you know, going from the past all the way to the present, the latest processors from Intel and AMD is known as Kaby Lake. That is the latest architecture from Intel. And the Ryzen, R-Y-Z-E-N, is the latest processor from AMD. And these are the latest ones. And Microsoft, a couple weeks ago, said that if you like your Windows 7, we won't allow you to run it on these new processors. And, well, you know what? When you throw
Hank, just a second. Did they really say that, or did they say these new processors wouldn't be official and wouldn't be getting any updates?
Well, basically, what they're saying is that they're going to run a test. If they see one of the new instructions, they will not. They'll allow you to run, but you won't get any updates. Now, there are updates on Windows 7 through the year 2020. And, Joe, one of the things that we all know is because if you go to a hospital, a doctor, or you know, anyone that's running a vertical application, many of these applications have not been converted to Windows 10. And Windows 7 is like still 40, 50% of the total installed market, and you just can't walk away from that. So,
Well, Microsoft seems to be walking away from it. How are the users letting them get away with it?
Well, they say that if it runs fine on your old machine, you keep your old machine, but you know what? If you want to run faster, you can still do it because there's a patch available from GitHub, GitHub.com/ZEFFY. We'll have this posted. It's called github.com/Zeffy. That's the good news. The bad news is, of course, it's a DLL patch. And if Microsoft were to say, oh, we see this patch, we'll kill it, that's really the good news. That means that when you don't want a force update, they don't realize it's there, so they won't do it. See, it's a catch-22 with Microsoft. You can get them on both ends. By the way, I got the high signal that we finally got through to Acronis, and let's get to the interview with Gaida. Gaida, are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, great. And you're up in Massachusetts. How's the weather up there?
Pretty bad, I would say. It was raining the last couple of days.
Well, I guess we got the rain first, and when it hits the, it travels up to your area, you get the rest of the water, huh?
Yeah, and it seems it's going to stay for a while.
Okay. Well, you know what? We did a, I did a overview of Acronis last week, and I just want to let people know that if you want to get that update or the that I gave on Acronis, they're available on the PRN.FM podcast as well as the WBAI.org. If you go to those websites, the podcasts are there. But can you just give us a brief one or two sentence? What is Acronis?
Acronis is the company that provides data protection solutions for consumers, businesses, and service providers.
That's a mouthful. Now, why don't you say backup?
Yeah, okay. Backup is easy, but we're actually more than backup. So we provide more capabilities. We provide disaster recovery capabilities as well. But we are mostly known among consumers and customers as the company that created Acronis TrueImage, which is the consumer backup.
Now, I went to your website, and more than one person that I've talked to have said that there's a little confusion because you have a one-time purchase price, you have a year subscription price, and you have a one-year subscription premium price, and then you have 1, 3, 5 years. Can you just give us a quick breakdown? Why all these breakdowns, and what are they?
Yeah, the options that we have actually based on what customers requested. So we have one option that is one-time purchase. When you just acquire the license of the product, you're getting the current version of the product, and you can keep using it forever. And that option comes with standard local backup. So you can back up to external drives, to local drives, to network drives. You can back up mobile devices, but only to a local computer. Then we have an option to purchase a subscription that is an annual subscription that comes with a little bit of cloud storage, and you can add more cloud storage as you go if you need that. And that also includes a premium phone support. And, you know, because phone support and the cloud storage has some additional cost to us, that's why it's an annual subscription, then you have to pay the annual fee. And the premium subscription is the option to get the product that has additional capabilities. One of those capabilities is active protection against ransomware. And also we have a special technology that allows to verify the backups and verify the data that you have using the blockchain, which we call Acronis Notary. It works basically as an authorization of the document and storing it the blockchain. And we have an electronic signature solution that is available as part of the premium subscription. So those are three options.
Well, one and of the things that... Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just wanted to close on the number of computers. So we have 135 computer option. So that's the number of computers, PCs or Macs. And every license comes with an unlimited number of mobile devices.
That's so what I want to get to. It's unlimited. Yeah. In other words, if I had eight people in the family on a family plan with T-Mobile, let's say, I can back up all eight mobile smartphones under the same license.
Yep. As long as you have enough storage in the cloud, or if you're backing up to a local computer, as long as you have disk space available on the local computer.
Joe?
The thing here that I think we should explain, because I got caught in that hook, is that you don't have the exact same features if you do a cloud backup as if you do a local backup. When you do, one of the great features of Acronis, as opposed to some of the systems I've used in the past, is when I do a full backup or a full image, if you will, I can pull out any part of that image, one file, one picture, one song, but not if it's in the cloud. Is that correct? Did I get that instruction right?
Actually, if you're backing up to the cloud, independently of what you back up, full image or just files and folders, you can go to the cloud portal and you can download any files that you want from that cloud portal. Or if you want to recover locally, you can just go to the recovery mode and select the particular files and folders that you want to recover. So it actually works absolutely the same as with the local storage.
Well, in that case, I'm going to have to give you some very bad news. Whoever wrote your online instructions didn't understand that. In red, they said you cannot selectively retrieve from the cloud. I'm glad to hear that it's the other way. I prefer to use the cloud. Right now, I'm using a very, very, very slow USB drive.
Yeah. Actually, I can share some information about how majority of our customers use the product. So most of our customers, they have multiple copies of their backups. So they have local backups, they have cloud backups, and they have multiple local backups as well. So they have a backup to an external drive. Sometimes they use multiple external drives and rotate them to have a few options in case one drive will go missing. Some prefer to use some NAS device or network storage. Some customers use the sync capability to create a replica of the data on another machine on the network. And that way they have multiple backup options and also have all the files stored on another machine. And that all that we know is that a lot of customers prefer to have at least two copies of their data, one copy locally and one copy somewhere offsite, either in the cloud, in the network, or on another computer.
You, when you say everybody, most of your customers would like to have multiple copies, you brought to mind a late colleague of ours who's just recently passed, Ross Greenberg. Wherever he went, whether it was dinner in a restaurant or a fancy dance and ball, always had a backpack with him. Not a very neat way of traveling. And I once asked him why, and he showed me in the backpack. This was in the days of floppies. He had maybe 70 or 100 floppies with him wherever he went, because if his office burned down, the same night that his home burned down, he would lose all of his work. So he always had his backpack with the backup. The Acronis backup has a very good feature. I haven't had a chance to try it, but Hank mentioned it, which is that I can use it on my cell phone, I can use it on my tablet, I can use it on my laptop, and I can use it on my desktop. Acronis doesn't care what operating system I'm using.
Yep.
By the way, in I've been trying to, you know, I'm sort of like the opposite of Joe. I have to get him, you know, pulling teeth for him to say, Joe, did you back up? I have to embarrass him on the air, whereas I do back up religiously. But in trying to get people to back up, there are three things that excuses that people give me is that I can't sit around waiting for the backup to be finished. You know, I you know, listen, it's the end of the day. I can't wait around an hour, 2 hours while it's backing up and I'm sitting there.
Hank, it's worse than that because last night, for example, I backed up. It took 4 hours.
Yeah, but you know what? You didn't read the manual, or actually there was no manual. It's a... you could back it up, and then there's a little option, right, Gaida, that you could say, after the backup finishes, turn off the machine.
Oh, I
saw
that.
Actually,
backup
usually works in the background, too. So when you work, the product, the Acronis TrueImage, will just identify what kind of resources are available. So if you're using a lot of computational power, the backup will be in a low priority mode. And then if you're not using the computer, it will be backing up everything. And actually, and if that, you use incremental backup, so usually the first backup takes a while, mm-hmm. but then every new backup backs up just the changes since the last backup, and it's usually super fast. So you will never actually notice that.
That's an excellent feature. Is it automatic that it will determine that it's running in the background and I really need some space for my word processing?
Yep, that's how it works. So I'm running the product on all my computers and my family computers and my friends' computers. And the beauty of it is just you install it, you configure backup once, and you can configure backup to multiple destinations if you want. And then it just runs. It just runs in the background. And if something happens, you just recover from the backup. But you don't have to think about it. You don't have to launch it. You don't have to control it. If something happens, it will tell you that you're running out of space, for example. You can even configure an email notification. So let's say if you have a backup running on, for example, your wife's or daughter machine or son machine, you'll get an email saying, hey, backup failed because there's not enough space. So you'll know about it.
Another complaint that I get from people, because I try to get them to back up, is that if I'm trying to do something, I have to stop what I'm doing. Otherwise, if the file is active, you don't back it up. I'm not saying you being a Cronus, but a lot of these other backup programs, if the file is active, it'll just skip over the program. Or worse yet, it won't even tell you that it skipped over it. But in the case of a Cronus, you can run it in silent mode and get the full backup, not a partial backup, right?
Yeah. You can do full backup. You can do incremental backup. And the way the product treats the file that they open right now, it will try to back up whatever is available here currently on the disk. So you can schedule, if you're using a local backup, for example, you can schedule a feature called nonstop backup. Then it will track the changes. And the moment you have a change, it will back it up. A lot of customers prefer to have backup daily. Some people prefer to have it hourly. But even if you have daily backup, usually it's good enough and definitely better than not having backup at all.
Oh, I agree with you totally on that. Now, I happen to know, but I'm going to let you do the explaining. What is the difference between an incremental backup and a differential backup?
It's just basically what is stored on a system. So basically, when you do incremental backup, you will have the first backup that will have a complete replica of everything you have. So basically, whatever you have on your drive will be the first version. And then when you do the incremental backup, all the next backups will have only the changes from the first backup. So whatever will be needed is basically when you need to recover, the product will find the files in the particular version of the backup, and then you recover those files.
Will the a Cronus work backwards to do the recovery? Because you have to work in reverse then to recover the files, right?
Yeah, but the product will do that automatically.
You mean automatically? A Cronus will do it automatically, but I've come across some backup programs where you have to figure out how to do it.
That's very sad. Yeah, so a lot of backups. So backup, it seems that backup is an easy solution, but it's not really an easy solution. There are so many tiny little details in it. So what can actually happen is that sometimes products will require you to find a particular file. So in case of a Cronus, you can choose the version that you need to recover. So let's say a simple case. So you are doing incremental backup. You had a first initial backup that is large backup. Let's say you have 100 gigabytes of data. So the first backup is 100 gigabytes. Then you made some changes to some files. Let's say you changed a lot. It will be like a 1 gigabyte. So the incremental backup will be a separate file that has only 1 gigabyte of data that was changed from the initial backup. Then you do some other changes. You have another incremental backup. So you have another piece of information and another smaller file. When you need to recover the full system, for example, you want to recover everything to the same computer or to another computer, then you will select which version of backup you want to recover. And then the product will do everything automatically for you based on what you want to recover, where you want to go back in time. The product will recover exactly what you need. So basically, what you will have is that you will be able to recover your data and you will save on storage space because you're not creating full backups every time. You're just creating a little file with the changes since the last backup.
Guido, common questions that I'm always asked is, because of all the different operating systems and different versions, where is that data I need to back up? I don't, it varies from operating system to versions of operating system.
So What do you mean by where is the data?
Yeah, in other words, I want to back up everything that I do. And if I'm running Outlook, it's in one area. If I'm running document processing, it's in another folder. In other words, it's not only in the user folder, it's also in other folders.
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty of Acronis is that you, as a user, can decide what you want to backup. You can select particular folders. You can create different schedules. So you can say, I want this folder to be a backup to that external drive every day, that folder to backup to this external drive or to network storage every hour. But the most interesting part would be is that you can select just full image backup. So you can say that backup everything. So you'll have the complete replica of your system with all the applications, files, settings, whatever you have in there. And then if you have some problem with your computer, you can recover everything exactly as it was. Or if you need to change the computer, you can recover to another computer and have everything, system application settings, everything as it was at the moment of the backup.
I would like you to comment on something which I found to be very useful is the hidden partitions.
Hidden partitions. So let's say if you want to have the exact replica of your disk, on your disk you can have the hidden partition that's used for recovery or used for storing some special information by the manufacturer created the computer. Then what you can do full image backup. Everything will be included, but if you want to backup only the user partitions without a hidden partition, you can select the method where you backup only particular partitions and then select them from the list of the available partitions. So you may choose to do that if you want to backup only the data that is user data in your system and you have it as a backup and you don't care about the factory settings or the copy of the operating system that was stored by the manufacturer in a hidden partition.
Well, the reason why I bring that up, Gaida, is because one of the problems posed by a lot of listeners that I get asked by is, you know, I have this hard disk drive. I want to switch over to a solid-state drive. How do I make sure I get everything up and running and I don't have to go through a fuss of reinstalling? And actually, I've used your product to just basically move everything from the hard disk drive to solid-state drive and just boot up right away.
Yeah, that's what I've done when I was moving from HDD to SSD. And basically, you just create full image backup and then use an external USB drive to boot from it and recover your backup to a new computer. Or if it's a bootable computer, it's already have an operating system, you can install Acronis Trimage and recover from backup using this Windows client. So that's how people do that. Another option, actually, is if you have a computer that can... To which you can attach a few disks. You can attach a few disk drives and you just clone one drive to another drive. And we have a special tool specifically for disk cloning. So instead of just backing up and recovering, you create a replica of your drive. And we're also smart enough to resize the partitions if you need to do that when you recover to another drive or clone to another drive.
Hey, Joe, now that I'm trying to get you to back up, has he convinced you to start backing up on a regular basis yet?
No, but what he has convinced me of is the importance of having a product like this. I hadn't ever thought of it because what he just said is it's smart enough to adjust the size of the partition as needed. Up until now, if I wanted to clone a drive, the partitions had to be exactly the same size. That's a very valuable feature.
Yeah, especially when you're moving to a new computer. Yeah. But to convince you that you need to backup, I'll show some interesting information that we'll learn from our customers. So we constantly in touch with our customers. We're surveying our customers, asking them different questions. Interesting thing that we learned is that people who are older have more childhood pictures than younger people. And the reason for that is because younger people usually have most of the pictures in a digital form, and they were not backing them up, and they were losing those pictures, while older people still have a paper copy that they can scan if they're losing the digital copy. So that was an interesting finding that many people find surprising.
Gaida, we're going to have to wrap it up, but can you have any final words of wisdom about backup and how we can get more people to understand backup is not all that difficult, but they should do it on a regular basis?
Actually, my final thought would be is that if you have a good backup tool, like a Chronist Tree Image, you don't really need to think about backup. You install it once, you configure it once, and it's just running, and it has your back. So you don't have to think about it. You don't have to spend time on it. And then if something happens, you can recover your data. But backup is important because people losing data all the time. And I believe that every listener can remember the time when some data were lost. Maybe something was deleted accidentally, maybe hard drive died, or someone stole the device. So that happens all the time.
Well, I just want to remind everyone that last week when I gave the review on Acronis, I also made the comment that Acronis is the best of breed when it comes to backup and recovery. And I just hope that even if you don't use Acronis, you need to still backup.
Well, I'd like to add two things to that, Hank. When you finally convinced me that I definitely needed backups for my business, if not my personal life, I backed up religiously to jumbo tape drives every night. Once the system crashed, and guess what? My jumbo tape drives did not work. I've been doing something wrong for months. Gita, how do people find out some more information about this product should they be smart enough to do so?
They just go to our website, acronis.com, and everything is there.
Okay. We have to go. Gaida, I just want to make one more comment that I know that with WBAI, we'll be fundraising, and you've made available a number of copies for us to use for fundraising. We thank you very much for your generosity.
And thank you. Thank you for having me here.
When does the fundraising start?
Next week. Gaida, I'll get in touch with you and Masha tomorrow, and I'll give you a transcript of this interview.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Thank you, and good night. Joe?
Hank, I'd like to add for our regular listeners that they don't have to call me for a transcript. It's online at pcradioshow.org, and it's online at prn.fm, and it's probably online someplace at BAI.
Oh, no, you're definitely right. It is online, except that I figure for Gaida, I'll just go through the personal service and just make sure that he gets it, and I'll tie it up with a transmission. we have to wrap up, Joe, on the regular broadcast, but I just want to tell people that we do have three feature segments, very interesting segments. Alfred Poor has something about wheelchairs. I think you want to hear about it. Joe Rajeski has another simple computer tip for busy people. And you're going to love what Marty Winston has to say about home automation, on how some people in the industry has sort of like made it sound so like it's nothing. Well, it's a big to-do about a lot of nothing from his point of view. You're going to find this very interesting. So we have these three segments coming up. And, Joe, final word before we run these three segments?
I'd like to ask, are we on live next week?
We are on live like regularly. Like today, it's a mixture of pre-recording and live. Next week will be the same thing. Now, on PRN next week, prn.fm, it will be a regular show. But on WBAI, I will go into the studio to do fundraising, and that's one of the things we have to do on BAI.
Well, what I was hoping you would say, I'll say for you, on prn.fm, we're always live, even if we're pre-recorded. We're never, ever preempted.
And we're thankful we're on prn.fm, by the way, because next week I say that I'm going to be fundraising, but I don't know if I'm really on or I'm being preempted. So we'll find out. Go to our website, pcradioshow.org, and we'll move on now to the feature segment.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. For the first story this week, I may be stretching the definition of wearables a little bit, but I want to talk about wheelchairs. Now, people with limited mobility have trouble getting around, and it limits their sense of independence and their ability to cope for themselves. So a wheelchair can be a wonderful addition to their lives and expand where they can go and what they can do. For some people, they need a powered wheelchair because they can't propel it themselves. And the most common form of propulsion for powered wheelchairs is electricity. Now, the problem here is that they can take a long time to recharge, typically 8 hours. They have a long distance that they can go on a charge, but they also have a limitation simply because they're powered by electricity. Electricity is fine in most settings, but it doesn't work really well in wet environments. And that's where this problem comes. What about people with limited mobility who want to enjoy a water park at a theme park? Their electrical-powered wheelchairs aren't suited for that. They can short out. It could be dangerous. And so that's not going to work for them at all. Engineers at the University of Pittsburgh have come up with a solution. In the Human Engineering Research Lab, they've developed what they call the new chair, except that's spelled P-N-E-U chair, like pneumatic. What this is a waterproof chair that actually uses compressed air as the power source. Now, it can only go about a third as far as an electrical-powered wheelchair can on a single charge. But on the other hand, it only takes about 10 minutes to recharge it with a new batch of compressed air, as opposed to 8 hours for recharging an electric wheelchair's battery. The chairs only weigh 80 pounds. Since they're only powered by air, there's no problem with water, so you can splash around in them and have fun. They were actually designed in response to a request from a place called Inspiration Island Splash Park. It's the first accessible family theme park in the U.S., and it includes a splash park. And so these wheelchairs, these new chairs, are used there. In fact, it's worked out so well that other groups are now looking into the use of the air-powered chair for other applications, even for home and shopping use and other places where people may want to use a powered wheelchair on a temporary basis. There's a lot of good news from modern medicine, not the least of which is how well we're doing against different forms of cancer. The number of deaths in the United States from cancer every year has actually declined steadily since the early 1990s. The number of cancer survivors continues to climb. Part of this is due to improved treatments, and one of the key treatments that's been effective is chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy is pretty rugged stuff. Basically, what they do is fill your body with highly toxic chemicals that attack the fast-growing cancer cells. These poisons are effective at killing off the cancer cells, but the problem is that they also tend to kill off other fast-growing cells. One of the most common types of fast-growing cells in our body, aside from cancer, are hair cells. Chemotherapy often attacks the hair cells and kills them, and that's why so many people lose their hair when they undergo chemotherapy. Now, there have been all kinds of approaches tried to help alleviate or minimize the effect. There are cooling caps that help restrict the blood flow and keep the scalp cool during chemotherapy, and that apparently can help some with the reducing the hair loss. But a new experiment's been done to see if they can't help encourage the recovery of the lost hair, to encourage faster hair growth following chemotherapy. There's a new study that followed a group of women who had undergone chemotherapy for breast cancer and had suffered hair loss as a result. Half the group was given a cap that contained low-power lasers and red LEDs, and then they used this targeted light treatment for 25-minute sessions at home every other day. A control group received similar helmets, but they just had standard incandescent lights in there, not the special frequency light that's produced by the lasers and the LEDs. They were tracked at 3 months and 6 months after using this treatment. At the end of 6 months, the results were pretty strong. It was found that the group that were using the lasers and LED light to encourage hair growth actually had a 2.6 times greater increase in individual hairs. And that's outstanding results. The study is continuing. If the initial results hold up, it may well be that this light treatment, the simple, non-invasive, inexpensive procedure, could help chemotherapy patients recover their hair and feel normal again much sooner after their chemotherapy. Most wearable devices require electricity for power, and that's not a big problem if you're working with a wearable device that you can take off and recharge. But what about implants? Trying to get power to a device that's buried inside your body can be a problem. especially if you're working with something that's temporary, that something that has a limited mission in a matter of months or so. So how do you get power to a temporary device like this? One of the problems is you don't want to use anything toxic, any of the typical battery technologies, because you don't want to run the risk of a leak or something damaging the casing of the battery or the device. How are you going to get power to these implants? A group has developed a very exciting and interesting approach to creating a battery. These researchers have created a thin film technology that uses pretty standard kinds of material, magnesium and a plastic electrolyte, all of which are biodegradable materials and non-toxic for the body. They then encapsulated the battery in silk, again, which is a biodegradable natural material. They discovered in their test that in a simulation of the body's fluids, the battery practically disappeared after 45 days. Furthermore, they found that by adjusting the thickness of the layer of silk that encapsulates the battery, they're able to control how long it takes for the battery to dissolve. With this approach, they're going to be able to create temporary medical implants that have their own power supplies, and you won't need to go through any procedure to get rid of the device, because it will just be absorbed by your body and disappear. So this could make all kinds of new applications possible and could greatly expand our definition of what a wearable health tech device might be. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
When you send an email from your mobile phone, are you advertising to the entire world that you're not at your desk? Well, we're going to fix that right now. Hey, it's time for simple computer tips for busy people. Busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejewski, author of the soon-to-be-released book, Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Now, sent from my iPhone, it's great for Apple's brand, but it doesn't do much for you. I recommend making your mobile phone signature identical to your Outlook or Gmail signature or whatever email program you use. And if you're using webmail, make that signature identical as well. Don't you want to be consistent and give the sense that you're at your desk working to help your clients and prospects at a moment's notice, even when you stepped away for a soup and a sandwich? I'm going to give you some instruction on how you can change your mobile phone signature. But first, I'm on my knees right now. I'm on my knees and I'm begging you, please remove "sent from my mobile phone, please excuse typos" from your signature. Instead, just type a little slower and use real words instead of abbreviations like THX for thanks. Did you lose your ability to spell because you were typing on a leprechaun-sized keyboard? Well, top of the morning to you then. We'll put another shrimp on the barbie, mate. Okay, I took you to Ireland and Australia in a matter of seconds. Let's get back on track. Okay, so if you're using an iPhone, to configure your iPhone signature from the home screen, just tap Settings. Then tap Mail, Contacts, Calendars. Tap Signature. You may need to scroll down for that. Tap Sent from my iPhone. Then type your signature so it matches your Outlook or Gmail signature or whatever email application you use. And you're all set. Now to configure your Android phone signature, open the email app, select More, select Settings. Under Accounts, tap your email account. Scroll down to Signature, make sure it is on. Tap Edit Signature. Type your signature so it matches your Outlook or Gmail signature, or, you guessed it, whatever email application you use. Click Done. If you own another mobile phone model, just search online for something like this. Google, how to configure a default email signature on a, insert your mobile phone model. It's that simple, folks. There you go. That's it. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Try this tip now and you will never, ever, ever forget it. Did you like this tip or do you have a computer tip for me? I want to hear about it. Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Brzezinski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe.
So, all right, if you go to 40yearhouse.com, you'll see the plans that we're working on for my smart house. Only, thanks to something Hank sent to me this week, I can't call it a smart house anymore. I may have to call it a smarter than a smart house. PC Mag, among other things, in rounding up what they treat as smart house stuff, says, I'm quoting, "Home automation is exactly what it sounds like. Automating the ability to control items around the house." Phooey. That's just remote control. If you're controlling the items, If automation is handling everything, oh yeah. Automation, unlike remote control, automation has three elements. It has sensors. It has controllers. It has actuators. If you don't have a controller responding to something it's sensing, it's not automation. And if nothing can be done about it, if there's no actuator to engage, why bother? What are you doing anyway? Here's what I wrote to the authors at PC Mag. By your definition, some of the elements of true home automation, old tech to be sure, include the coiled spring tilt switch thermostat, the clock motor-driven lighting timer, the photoelectric front light control. Those wouldn't make your cut. They are controlling things themselves, automatically, autonomously, without needing a user, without having somebody on a smartphone to push their buttons to make things happen. Tell me if these things sound like home automation to you. This is part of what I wrote them, despite being absolutely disassociated from any remote control. Number one, Bluetooth beacons in the cars let a car entering the driveway open any one of many garage doors appropriate to that car with no one pushing a button. Number two, a smoke alarm triggered system turns off all fans, turns off the HVAC, turns off the natural gas feed after the generator tap, places voice calls to two fire departments, and unlocks all exterior doors. Is that somewhere in remote control? I don't hear a remote control in there. Surveillance cameras linked to an irrigation, that sprinkling system, so that watering will pause in zones that you walk onto or across. Of course, if you've got a security system, you could do the flip side of that and make sure nobody who doesn't belong out there leaves dry. And number four, responding to a leaking toilet flapper by shutting off the water feed to that toilet, but letting it turn back on whenever somebody is in that bathroom. What are you going to do? Call in from work and say, toilet, somebody's using you, go ahead? No, you can't do that. That's not a remote control application. Remote control doesn't belong there. Does a puppeteer automate a marionette or simply remote control it? Which are we looking to do? An Android is fully autonomous, fully automated. A robot could be a little of both. It's programmed, it does things, and it can alter according to circumstance. An automaton, like an old record changer, just does one thing well over and over, and it may be somewhat complex, and it may have some small adaptation, but it's not an Android. Now, admittedly, the things that I mentioned don't add up or support a magazine puff piece done to please potential advertisers in some trade-assigned category. And I said to the guys, if you have more duty to the advertisers than to your readers, so be it. I'm not one to argue with a paycheck, but maybe, just maybe, you could reword your definition a bit. Well, let's get back. Enough with PC Mag. Goodbye. I'm not reading you anymore. I've read you for, seems like, 1,000 years. Let's get back to what automation should be. Automation should be automation. Does it? You don't have to be there. You don't have to push a button. Having automation in a house, in my mind, isn't about giving you more things to remote control, adding to your little control chores. Oh my goodness, I forgot to remote control the light. No, that's not it. It's about taking those chores away. It's about letting the house handle itself. It's about making things smart enough that you don't have to be there to respond to every little change of everything. It's like you want to stand next to the thermostat and every time it gets a little hotter or colder, readjust it. Well, isn't that what a thermostat does by itself? What are you going to do that's different? Oh, you're going to be able to control it from work. Yeah, right. Gee, I have the thermostat set for 71. I'm going to change it to 68.3. Nobody will know who did it. Oh, grow up. You know what I'm saying? You don't need to adjust your thermostat from afar. You also don't need to make yourself vulnerable to the guys who are now doing thermostat control ransomware. Whole other issue, whole other topic. The piece about the PC Mag article that I find offensive, yes, offensive, is that it diminishes all of us to being lackeys of the merchandising of products that are incomplete in their approach to what they should be doing. Really, look, you want to buy home automation stuff off the shelf at an electronics store or buy it online. You're a grown-up, or you've got the money, or whatever. You know, make your own decisions. Learn from them. Don't learn from them. I'm not your daddy. You know, your decision is yours. But what I can tell you is you're not likely to be happy with it later. What are you going to do, show off? That, in fact, is why most home automation purchases are made, to show off. Hey, bud, look what I can do on my cell phone. I made my garage door open. Hey. Yeah, right. Who needs that? Well, the guy who wants to break in your garage would like it. That's okay. What do you really want to automate? You want to have lights that come on? There are all kinds of ways to do that, from switches, hey, lights on, to timers, to photoelectric controls. You can get more complex, but you don't need it. You know, one of the major companies in building a data center built it with no light switches. They just automated everything. They used mostly passive infrared to determine occupancy and vacancy, which means you need motion, but that's not terrible. So you go in the facility, lights are on when you're there, lights are off when you're not there. It knows what before and after hours are. If the room's already light, it doesn't turn on electric light. That's pretty smart. That's automation. That's a good thing. You don't have some guy sitting in a booth with a million monitors and a whole bunch of keyboards going, oh, look at the light level. Boop, boop, boop. Better turn it up. No, that's not how it should work. How it should work is without you. That's what automation is. Do it automatically. When's the last time you went down to the creek with the washboard to wash your clothes? Oh, no, you throw it in that big tub and it goes round and round, washes everything and then spins it so it can go to the dryer. That's automation, isn't it? Be even more automated if your hamper went directly to it. Be even more automated if you ever had an Android in the house to take it in. But for what it does, it's automated and you don't need to remote control it. Why do you need to remote control things? Yeah, fine. You don't want to get off the chair. You don't want to get off the couch to change the channel on the TV. And you don't want to program it to automatically change from one program, in this case show, to another. And fine, you know, that's a good remote control use. That's fine. You've got a window air conditioner or a humidifier in a room, and you want to be able to turn it on or off without getting out of bed. You know, that's not unreasonable. Could you automate it? Yeah. But if it's a $50 or $100 item, you might want to not pay another $300 to automate it. So make a choice, you know, your money. Are you going to use it wisely? You're going to use it for fun? You're going to use it to show off? Show off. Look, I can tell when there's mail in the mailbox. I can talk to a guy at the front door over a speaker there, and he doesn't know I'm not home. Yeah, well, he does. The bad guys all know by now that if it's a speaker, you're not home. Don't be taken in by the promise of being a whiz-bang Georgie Jetson kind of guy. That's not what it's about. Automation, well, you make your own decision. But in my mind, automation should be all about and only about simplifying my life. Automation is a prescription for those of us who would prefer to have fewer chores, for those of us who don't worship laziness but sure as heck enjoy it. I think that's enough for me. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Next week, the Personal Computer Show will be in two parts. We can be heard with a regular program on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio. It will be a membership drive to raise funds to operate, and it will be on at 9 p.m. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, April the 27th at 6:45 p.m., and the topic of presentation is Scary Alphabet Soup, which is new television technologies at CES. The meeting will be held at the Middletown Library Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on how to buy a personal computer, and it runs the gamut from smartphones to desktops. Tuesday, May 2nd, 2 p.m., Community Room at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a meeting on drones and radio control technology Tuesday, May 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Eat Well, Think Clearly, and Live Fully, May 4th, 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120, that's 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, May the 5th, 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting May 9th, 7:15 p.m. on Tuesday, Rasa Room at the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, West Nyack, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on how to self-publish ebooks, audiobooks, and paperback books, Thursday, May 11th, 7 p.m. at NYU 32 Waverly Place, the Silver Building in New York, Manhattan. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. Next week, the Personal Computer Show will be in two parts. We can be heard with a regular program on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio. And Acronis is making available a number of copies of the Acronis backup program we've been talking about, and it will be made available at the fundraising membership drive on WBAI next week. It will be on at 9 p.m. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station next week.